This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Helen Sheehy about her novel, Just Willa. And since it's not in front of us, and it maybe wouldn't be, people wouldn't know how to spell it, it's Willa, W-I-L-L-A, just like Willa Cather. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be here.
So I know you have written mostly nonfiction before mm-hmm. this book. This is your first novel. And you've been a biographer for quite a while. And you've written three biographies about theatrical people. I think is a good background for writing a biographical or a semi-autobiographical novel, which this is. But maybe you could talk a little bit about your experience as a writer of nonfiction, kind of preparing you to write a novel.
Well, I wrote three biographies, as you say, of theater pioneers, and I loved it. I spent about 7 years on each one, 25 years of my life, probably writing those three books. And it was just, I fell in love with biography. There was something wonderful about it. And the whole biography is sort of a spring task of bringing to life again, someone wrote. And it's true. You really want to make people live on the page. But one of the reasons I wanted to write a novel was because, David, as I've gotten older, I find myself wanting to do the things that I liked when I was young. And one of the things that I really loved when I was young was making stuff up. And after 25 years of dealing with footnotes and sources, and I'm one of those biographers that is really diligent about facts, I don't say something unless I really have three sources or it comes right from a diary or a letter. So I'm sort of meticulous about that. But it's really time consuming. And so by the time I wrote the last one, Eleonora Duse, I wrote about, the first modern actor. And after I did that, I thought, I'm kind of done with biography. I mean, who am I going to write about after this? I've written about Eleonora Duse. But I'd been thinking for a long time, especially after my mother died when I was 36, and she had never seen any of these books. And I realized I knew more about these women than I knew about my own mother. I knew so little about her. And I had charted the arc of their lives. I'd gone into their deepest, darkest thoughts and feelings and fears. But about my mother and her background and her family, I didn't know anything. So I decided, and you ask about how biography helped me. And how it helped was that when I first started researching it, I went back to Freedom, Oklahoma. And what I do with all of my biographical figures, I try to walk the ground they walked. You just want to breathe that air. You want to see what it was like, even though it may be years later. You still need to put yourself kind of in their footsteps. So I did that. And then I started digging into all the information that I have. And my own immediate family doesn't have a lot. And there's a reason that is revealed in the book why there isn't much material from our family. But I did have cousins and aunts and people to talk to and listen to family stories. And oh boy, newspapers from this period. So we're talking about early 20th century. Willa in the book is born in 1917, but it also goes back to the Oklahoma land rush of 1893. Her father, who founded the homestead in Freedom. So I wanted to find out about that. And by the way, that homestead is still in our family. It's now belongs to my cousin Kai, who is a Angus breeder. He breeds the cattle that the commercial people use for their beef cattle. Mm-hmm. So he's sort of a step above that. But all that, it's still there. The land sort of pretty much looks the same as it always has. So anyway, I gathered all that material, but then I realized, because people had suggested, could you write this as a memoir or autobiography? No, I couldn't possibly, because I didn't have enough information. So I had to invent and imagine, because I do not know how my mother met my cowboy, boxer, bootlegging father. So I had to imagine that. And there are only a certain amount of possibilities in Freedom, Oklahoma, how they might meet. So I imagined that. And I found that so liberating. It was wonderful not to have to worry about, you know, just trying to get at the truth you wanted to tell about this woman's life. But part of it, I'm making it sound as if I knew where it was going, but I really didn't, because I'm trained in the theater and a lot of improvisation. So writing for me was sort of figuring it out as I go along, as I wrote, like, who was she? So I really didn't know where I was going until I got there, which was 20 years later. I started in 2004 or somewhere in there with the research. And then here we are in 2025.
So that's so really interesting to think about your process, which in a way is, you know, it's really different than a lot of other writers, because you are writing, I mean, almost always, you know, the argument is, or if you're writing about yourself, you're always writing about yourself. Help it. Even if you're writing, you know, a mystery about, you know, 1875, somehow you're really writing about yourself. So, but in this book, you know, in a lot of ways, it kind of focuses that pretty clearly, or frames it clearly.
Uh-huh.
But I'm sort of curious, when you said you started writing and you didn't know where it was going, literally, did you start writing a narrative, or did you write notes and pieces and then later figure it out?
I work the same way I do with biography. I gathered all the material that I possibly could find. And I read a lot of newspapers from the period. My grandmother wrote for the newspaper, the Freedom Call. So there's a lot of material there. It's amazing what people used to write in the newspapers. It's shocking, actually. I can't believe that they could get away with doing that. But there are so many novels in these old newspapers. It's just amazing. So I gathered all that. I don't know if you know the novel, Mrs. Bridge. I had read that book years earlier. And then I looked at it again, and what he did is so interesting. I mean, our books are totally different, and our protagonists are very different. But he had these short chapters. They were almost like snapshots or a window into her life. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. But then somebody else pointed out to me, actually, it was my nephew. He said, well, isn't that what Thornton Wilder does in Ironton? You just sort of look. I thought, oh, I guess that's true. And that's actually my favorite play. So maybe, and I've seen it. I've directed it. I've seen it a million times. He actually lived here in Hamden. Did you know that, David?
Yes.
So, you know, it didn't start maybe with Evan Connell, but that sort of liberated me, that I didn't have to write the kind of biographical covering every inch of her life, that I was writing something else. And that was really freeing. But figuring out the structure, I had the stories. I really had a lot of stories, probably way too many stories. And I had the characters, but I didn't have the structure. And that was the most difficult thing. Like, where do you begin? What do you leave out? Where do you end? And actually, the ending was easier, because it is sort of it's the arc of Willa's life. So that was there. But all the other, that was very difficult for me.
Well, I think you hit on a really good starting point. I think this, you know, and I don't think it's giving anything away to readers, because it's at the very beginning. You're going to have to start there. But it's a really good opening scene. And of course, you have her burning.
Yes.
Her stuff. And it's
the burn barrel.
There's something elemental about that, pretty obviously, you know, burning it down, burning it away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's really unhappy, and you don't know why, you don't know anything about her, but
exactly.
The scene is very powerful. And of course, the discovery of a box gives her an entry into the past. And I think I have a feeling that many people would share that feeling of discovery when you find a box of old letters or a box of old papers. I've done that recently, so I've been thinking about that. I found a box of letters that I'd put away in my parents' house in 1971, 72,
oh boy.
Or 73, I think, and hadn't looked at it in 50 years. And it was really revelatory.
Oh, I'm sure it's Because it's so immediate. It takes you back into that precise time. It's of that moment, and it's just invaluable.
Right. And for her,
yeah,
you can see that it, you know, that gives you a good, structure for mm-hmm. their telling of, so you switch from the narrator, the narrator is a first person mm-hmm. teller, which is you, the daughter,
mm-hmm.
as, you know, in the character that you've created for her. But then right. you switch it to really being about Willa.
Exactly.
Which makes it, you know, kind of, I think that's a good introduction.
Thank you.
By the time I finished the book, I actually had forgotten that that's how it started. You know, it's like I had to go back.
Oh, interesting.
Because, you know, it comes, you repeat some of the introductory material as mm-hmm. part of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But at least for me, you know, maybe it's just because of the way I read, I just didn't remember how it opens.
Mm-hmm. Well, and plus you get that sense, and there, I think the idea of that landscape and just the idea of fires going through there, because that's always a constant, that's a constant worry out there too. But for me, the idea of, as you find out when you read the book, the whole idea of stirring the ashes and figuring out what's left, you know, what can I save from these ashes? That for me was just, this book almost was an obsession with me in a way that it wasn't. The biographies weren't. I mean, in some ways, I mean, I love doing them and it was a job. This was more, I have to get this right. I have to figure this out. It became incredibly personal. And I was worried about that. I was worried that who would care about this ordinary woman from Freedom, Oklahoma? And you talked about the title and the idea of it. It's just Willa, you know, she's nobody. Who's she? But she's also just Willa. And I have been so heartened by the response because it just reminds me. I mean, there was a guy in Brooklyn who told me he just loved it. And he had never been on a farm. I don't think he's ever been to Oklahoma, but it doesn't matter because there's something about all art is local. It's just local. And it's the thing that interests me as a writer is trying to figure out how do people actually live their lives. I mean, in the really gritty details, those choices, what's their day to day? What do you actually do at your job? Do you know what I'm saying? That kind of really close up look at things that fascinates me about people.
Well, and of course it is, you know, you reveal in a way by this telling a story that what appears to her to just be the day to day and is not doesn't make her happy, doesn't fulfill her. So she misses the fact that she's lived a fulfilling life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a certain way, she doesn't even know that.
Exactly.
Until maybe at the end, she's happier because she's having reviewed the whole arc of her life. She has, although she's still worried about the one daughter who is a problem and, you mm-hmm. know, and you also think about, you know, and also the people are a different time and place. She mm-hmm. comes from a, you know, a hardscrabble
exactly
environment. And I think as we think about what people's lives were like prior to the modern era,
mm-hmm.
because work was so
all consuming.
It didn't give them the same sense of self-reflection. And, you know, this is sort of, if you think about Freud opening the world to the idea of psychological being,
mm-hmm.
that only works if you have time.
I so agree with that. Yes, yes. I mean, that was something that I think I'm interested you're picking up on that, because these people, they don't have time in the day. I mean, it's sun up to sundown. But what she did know, what Willa does know, she realizes it, that she does not want Ellie or Annie, her other daughter, and or their boys. She doesn't want them to have that life. But one of the things that I think the reader will have to come to grips with, as I sort of did, is So what does this mean about, how does Willa think about her own life? You know, what does she think? And I think that everybody will have their own opinion about how she comes to grip with that. But just on a personal level, I remember when I was, I think I must have been 9 or 10, because I know that I could drive it. I drove the pickup to haul hay when I was probably 9, 8. I really, really wanted to drive the tractor so badly. I threw a huge fit. My dad wanted me to drive the tractor. My mother put her foot down. She says, "You're not going to do it." So what that meant is that I was in the house by myself. But David, what I did was I read nonstop. I mean, I read probably a book a day. And I am so grateful now that I didn't have to drive that tractor and probably end up with skin cancer later, because I would have been out there with, you know, no sunscreen. But she made a very conscious decision that education, that having a different life for her kids was really important.
Right. And she did not. She had to leave school at eighth grade.
Yep.
Give up her dream of going to high school. Her father wouldn't let her go, which I think clearly is a big deal for her. And there's a scene, you know, there's a scene later in the book where it's fairly, you know, you sort of feel badly for her. Because she realized, see, I think that she does, as you show her or portray her, she does have a level of self-reflection. I don't mean to say that just because you're not Freud or you don't have time to, you know, be psychologically oriented, you can't be self-reflective. I think she is way more than her husband.
Oh my gosh. And the choices she makes about her husband and about Jake and that situation that happens with him. I mean, does she let him know that she knows his secret? Does she tell him? And then I grappled with that because she is so rigorous about telling the truth, about no lies. But then she has to make a very difficult, and I understand why she decides what she does, because I think you're right, David, that she does know. She knows him. She understands him. She understands her family, the community, what would happen to her own life. So she gets it.
Although that burning secret is what probably gives her the ulcer.
I know. Oh, that's probably true. Yes. And just that constant worry.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you can't really blame her. Every parent worries about their children nonstop, even when they're grownups, even when they're having a great life or whatever they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think a parent anywhere doesn't stop worrying. And she has many kids. And
right. A lot to worry about.
Worms do. And she has also experienced loss in a real way that is unimaginable, I think, in some ways, and just terrible. Things have happened to her. So she has pain that has to be buried.
Exactly.
Like the people that are buried, because, you have to live, you know, as she says, get with it. You got to keep going.
I know. And that whole sort of, but did you get, I'm curious, because I felt after this book was published and I actually looked at it again and read it again, it seems so far away from our time.
Oh,
and it's the 20th century. It's not that, it's my lifetime. But it, to me, where we are right now and the values and all of these, it's just, for example, when I went to these little town public schools, and I'm the daughter of a tenant farmer. We were poor. And I went to school with kids who, very wealthy landowners with their parents, there was absolutely no class distinction, because your value and who you were depended on what kind of a person you were, what kind of a student you were. Also, sports was very important. But I never, ever felt lesser because we didn't have money. I mean, and nobody would ever brag about it. And it's considered very bad form, where I was raised, to talk about how much land you own. Nobody would ever ask you, you know, how many acres you have. No. You would never say that. But I think that's totally different now. It's all, and I didn't dress that much different. And we just all kind of look the same.
I think there are differences that are regional too, not just, so it's time and space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think about this when I read about my, you know, stuff about my family that lived in northern Minnesota, and they, you know, lived really, it was hard in the early 1900s, late
1900s. And cold.
Very cold and really hard work. And it's just so different, you know, that I have a great aunt who taught school in the Iron Range of northern Minnesota.
Oh my God.
Every morning she had to get up and break the ice, on the bucket and then start a fire so that 12 kids
could come
and take classes. To me, that's unimaginable. And that was 1913. So,
right.
Or maybe 1918. Still, it is 100 and some years ago, but I think the world of Boston or New Haven, New York, Connecticut in 1912, 1920 was probably really different from the world out there.
Yes.
And, you know, we've had this sort of social leveling on one hand because people now have goods that were harder to come by, like electricity.
Well, indoor toilets. Because
indoor plumbing, exactly. I mean, a lot of the places out there didn't get electricity until well after the 30s.
Oh, absolutely. Right.
Although, this is kind of funny, Connecticut story. I was at the Shelton, Connecticut Historical Society once, and an old guy who helped found it showed us the school bus that he went to school on in 1936. It was a horse-drawn school bus in suburban Connecticut.
Oh, my gosh.
It was rural Connecticut, but still.
Never even heard of such a thing.
Yeah. Ugh. So the world has really changed so much. And I think World War II was kind of the point where literally the culture changed.
Mm-hmm.
But your book does take place in a world that's really different for...
But even when you go into the 80s, the 70s and 80s in the book, it still seems to me it's still really different. There's just kind of a divide.
I think that's geographical.
Yeah.
You know, I have not spent a lot of time in southern Kansas, northern Oklahoma.
Oh. Pretty much the same. I was just there because we had a launch party in Wichita. And so I spent some time in Freedom. It hasn't changed. The cemetery still looks pretty much the same. The old homestead, there's no trees still. Because if you're going to homestead land, I don't think you would want to have to uproot a bunch of trees. You'd want to have that farm ground. But I've been told by my cousin that it won't be long before nobody's running cattle on that land. They're buying it up now for recreation. Yes, here, hunters from Florida and Georgia, they're buying up thousands of acres. They're going to build a big lodge on the creek or on the Cimarron River, and they're going to visit it a couple times a year. And so that land will go back all to grass and big trophy deer, and the schools will close because nobody lives there anymore.
But in a way, I mean, I do think I love the idea of the prairie being restored. That's something that I really believe in. That, you know, changing the landscape as as the settlers of the late 19th century did. I mean, they re-engineered millions of acres of land, and
that's right,
so radically. It wouldn't be bad if it went back to prairie, I think.
No, even now, though, I mean, for decades, the government has been paying farmers not to to let the land go fallow. They'll give them they'll basically rent it. They'll give them a certain amount of money for so many acres just to let it go back to natural grass. And, you know, it's probably not good wheat ground anyway. So a lot of that has already started happening.
Well, it is really dry out there, too.
It's very dry. That's why there's so many wildfires lately, because it's so dry, which could be a big fear if all that land goes back to grass and it's going to have to go back to that process of burning and then, you know, regrowing and all of that.
Of course, maybe they'll bring the buffalo back, huh?
Wouldn't that they? Well, up in Nebraska, I think they do. There's some people who have some buffaloes. In fact, my niece, she had three buffalo at her place. I think she eventually sold them. But yeah, people are doing that. It's such a different world. It's just so different out there. It's really stunningly beautiful, I think, around Freedom, the Red Canyons, the Cimarron, the Red Bluffs overlooking the river. It's stunning.
That's cowboy country, right?
It's cowboy country. Definitely. Definitely. In fact, the Freedom Rodeo there, it's called the biggest little rodeo in the West. It's the whole town was about 300 people, but then at rodeo time, it would grow to about 10,000, 15,000 people. And everybody's sleeping on the floors. And oh my gosh, it's like a 3-day bacchanal party.
Rodeo.
Yes. And dances. And oh my gosh.
Well, it is really interesting. Yeah, it is. I think it is really interesting to think about how different it is, and maybe was more so in the past. But, you know, as you go through it is different today than it was 50 years ago. So it's, you kind of think about it as how much different is it today from what it was? And how much different is it there from other places? There's sort of a graph to try and figure out kind of, I don't mean alien in a bad way, but kind of the differential for people living there, because their experience is definitely different from people who live in other parts of the country where the population is greater, their population density is greater.
Exactly.
Maybe that's the difference.
Well, the sad thing that's happened to Freedom, that little town, is that because it's so isolated, it couldn't really consolidate its school. So the school is tiny. And so out there, the public school is sort of the center of the town. And that's if you lose population, but the school actually is still open there, which amazes me. I think there's one class that has one student. I know.
It's sort of, that really worries me about the whole middle of the country, where as you drive through, you come across towns where they have buildings that are, boarded up, and there just aren't enough people. And, you know, then you get that spiral where people won't stay because there aren't services. And then there are fewer and fewer services because there aren't enough people to support
them. But that's sort of natural in a way, because think about it. In the 30s, I don't think agriculture was more than like 25% of the people working in agriculture. It wasn't. And now it's so small, like just a couple of percent.
Right. It's about 3.5%.
We're really nostalgic for it. I mean, I wanted to make this book I didn't want to romanticize farm life, because there's nothing romantic about it. It's just unrelenting labor. It really is. And there's joy to it. I mean, there's always something dying on a farm, but there's always something being born on a farm, and there's independence. But it's really hard to make a living on a farm. It's very, very difficult.
And that's one of, that's kind of demographically why there are so few people working on farms, because it is so difficult.
Right.
Although it's also a social economic issue, because, the structure of our economics does not enable small-scale farming. And even people who have resources and try to do it today find it almost impossible.
Do you know, though, I have a friend who's a young woman who goes to University of Connecticut, and she wants to become a very small farmer here in Connecticut. She wants to be able to buy maybe 5-10 acres and do that. So it's still there. There's still people who want to do that. We're going to need to be fed. But I think, she's very aware of what it requires to be able to do that. But it's going to be, I was talking to my cousin who has that beef, and he said, beef's luxury now. It's a luxury item. It's going to become more rare. It's going to become more specialized, the kind of beef you get, the grass-fed, the kind of the perfect beef. But then maybe it too will disappear. I don't know. Maybe that's just progress. What do you think, David? Are we just progressing?
I don't know how I feel about progress, but I do believe, I do think that it is a value for localism to exist so that we have a local web of relationships with the people who feed us, who can make a living from doing that. I think that's a value that's greater than just, it's not a romanticization of it. It's actually meaningful, and it's also beneficial.
Right.
So, you know, I kind of believe in a sort of modern Jeffersonianism that would restore the notion of value to it, to laborious life, and make it not be looked at as something to escape. So there has to be a, you know, it has to be combined with other values to make it work. You know, we live in Connecticut. I've been here all my life. I feel like Connecticut as an agricultural area or state has, that went away 150 years ago. But some of the values that agriculture and living close to the people who produce food is restorative.
I couldn't agree more. 9 miles from where I live, I can end up at this wonderful farm where they have cattle and horses and donkeys, and it reminds me of Freedom, Oklahoma. So it just amazes me that 9 miles, about 15 minutes away, I am transported back to that world that I can leave after I ride or whatever I'm doing, and I don't have to do the work. But those people are doing the work, and there are other people out there who have small organic farms or just small farms, and I love that. And I think the towns in the Midwest, like Protection, Kansas, there's a wonderful farm there. They sell beef, they sell vegetables. There's sort of that localism that you're talking about. Some towns can't quite make it, but others are going, you know, some of them are doing quite well with that. And people love that life. There's something, I just feel my shoulders relax sometimes when I get to Oklahoma. Everything is just slower.
Well, you can tell from reading the book that you love the place and you love the people, and the writing is really good. So
thank you.
I think I really enjoyed the book, and I think that's a good place for us to end. But I want to thank you for doing this. It was really fun talking to you, and I hope that this conversation may lead some people to read Just Willa.
Oh, I hope so. Thank you so much, David. I really enjoyed it. It was great.
My pleasure. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Helen Sheehy about her novel, Just Willa.